Good morning, everyone, and welcome back. It's my pleasure to introduce the third panel of the morning, Big Tech in the Future of Section 230. Our moderator this morning is Judge Brantley Starr. Judge Starr was appointed to the United States District Court for the Northern District of Texas in August 2019. Before his appointment, Judge Starr was the Deputy First Assistant Attorney General of Texas. Prior to that, he served as the Deputy Attorney General for Legal Counsel. From 2011 to 2015, Judge Starr served as career staff attorney to former Texas Supreme Court Justice Eva Guzman. And from 2008 to 2011, he practiced at King & Spalding. Before that, and apropos of the previous panel, he served in the Office of Solicitor General under then-Solicitors General Ted Cruz and Jim Ho. Judge Starr was the first law clerk to then-Justice Don Willett on the Texas Supreme Court after serving for Judge Willett at the Office of Attorney General. Judge Starr received his law degree from the University of Texas and his Bachelor of Arts from Abilene Christian. It's my pleasure to introduce to you all Judge Starr.
Thank you, Brad, or should I say Barry White. We were talking earlier that over the course of FedSoc weekends, our voices just grow weary and get lower and lower. So Brad and I are both in that phenomenon. I found Pre-Shaw's name tag in the lobby, and so I just started wearing it, so I'm not actually Pre-Rack Shaw. He is the acting United States Attorney for the Northern District. I realize that wearing it is a violation of the separation of powers, so I'm going to remove it. Pre, you can come get your name tag anytime you want during this panel. It's right here. Okay, well, thank you for joining us for our discussion on Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act and the future of big tech. We all know perhaps more about the background of what is going on in society rather than the legal framework that's behind it all. So you know, under the auspices of Section 230, big tech platforms are able to flag posts for misinformation, are able to block posts entirely or kick users off of platforms. We've had Twitter kick a former president off of its platform, but who can tweet? Who can tweet are various members of the Taliban, but also your favorite band, Nickelback. Why? Underlying all of this is the general notion that under Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, there's a liability shield for those who are publishers of content but censor certain offensive content in good faith. Justice Kagan said famously, we're all textualists now, so instead of looking at Nickelback, let's look at the text of Section 230, shall we? So the core of 230 is C1 and C2. C says, protection for Good Samaritan blocking and screening of offensive material. C1 is treatment of publisher or speaker. No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. But wait, there's more. C2, civil liability. No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be held liable on account of A, any action voluntarily taken in good faith to restrict access to or availability of material that the provider or user considers to be obscene, lewd. Professor Volok, a little help?
I believe it's lascivious.
Lascivious, excellent. I'm from West Texas. Thank you for stepping in.
Well, I'm from Russia, so imagine asking a Russian.
Then you might know the word well. We'll see. Filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable, whether or not such material is constitutionally protected. Or B, any action taken to enable or make available to information content providers or others the technical means to restrict access to material described in paragraph one. That, in a nutshell, is Section 230. We have an all-star panel today to help us understand how we got Section 230, what the possible interpretations of it are, what the actual experience that big tech companies have is today, and what the future holds. So I'll start off with introductions in the order that we're going to hear opening remarks. So we'll hear first from Professor Jeff Kosef. He's an associate professor of cybersecurity law at the U.S. Naval Academy. He literally wrote the book on this subject. From 2019, it's called The 26 Words That Created the Internet. He clerked for Judge Mylon D. Smith of the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, and then also clerk for the Eastern District of Virginia. He can help us walk through what Congress's motivations were when passing Section 230. Then we have Professor Eugene Volok. He teaches First Amendment law in a First Amendment amicus brief clinic at UCLA Law School. He's written two books on the First Amendment. He's probably written 38% of the law review articles you've ever read in your life. And in his spare time, he founded and co-authors the vaunted Volok Conspiracy. As a side note, once upon a time, I was a publisher as editor-in-chief of Texas Review of Law and Politics, and I published a piece of his. So we have some history with regard to this framework that Section 230 creates. And then no offense to our members of the Academy who are here today, but sometimes we also want to hear the perspective of what's happening in practice in the real world. And that's why we asked Kate Tumorello to be here. She is the executive director of Engine. And Engine is a nonprofit that works with a community of thousands of high-tech, growth-oriented startups across the nation to support technology entrepreneurship. I'll say in layman's terms, Ms. Tumorello can help be the translator between Congress and tech companies because they don't always speak the same language. She can give us that experience of what's happening on the ground. In her former life, she actually worked on surveillance reform issues at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and was a technology policy reporter working with such organizations as Politico and The Hill. And then our missing piece of the puzzle is we don't necessarily know what the courts are doing and what states are doing. And that's why Brian Barnes is here. He's a partner at Cooper Kirk. As far as what states are doing, you might have seen that Florida passed a law banning viewpoint discrimination from big tech companies. And Mr. Barnes actually worked on that litigation challenging the validity of that law. Texas has recently followed suit. And so we need to touch on how the courts are interpreting Section 230, but also touch on what states are doing and how courts are interpreting what states are doing. You might know Mr. Barnes better for his work on Collins versus Yellen, a case he won recently at the U.S. Supreme Court, testing just how independent agencies are. So with that, I will turn it over to our panelists in that order that I introduced them. So Professor Kosef, I'll ask you all to go 10 to 12 minutes for opening remarks. I'll have some questions at the end of that time for our audience to be thinking of questions to ask them. We'll try to end a little bit early so we can get to lunch and start promptly at 12:45. So that's our goal for today. And Professor Kosef, I promise that if there is content you say that I do not agree with this publisher, I will not mute your microphone. So the floor is yours.
I appreciate that. Thank you. And thank you for having me here. I have to first start off with the disclaimer that everything I say is only on my behalf, I have to get the list right, not on behalf of the Naval Academy, the Department of Navy, or the Department of Defense, or the U.S. government, just me, and you'll probably see why that's really important within a few minutes. I'm going to talk about the purpose of 230. I just first want to say it's fascinating to me and that we're having an entire session on Section 230. When I first started writing my book in 2015, I will say that there were academic publishers who found Section 230 to be too obscure for a book. And look at what some things academic publishers publish, and you'll see why it is pretty shocking to me now that we're devoting many sessions to what I think obviously is a really important law. So what I want to do is talk, and I could obviously talk for hours about mechanics of 230, but I'm going to focus on a part of the research that I did into Congress's motivations for passing Section 230. And I'll say that I'm probably on Twitter more than I or my family thinks that I should be on, so I interact with a lot of people who will message and say, hey, this was Section 230 was a plot by Google and Facebook. And I respond, Mark Zuckerberg was 11, so that would have been a pretty interesting plot. It has a fairly unique and not very direct legislative history when you're looking at it. And there's actually not all that much officially in the record. Section 230 was written in 1995. And to understand why it was written, you have to think about two court cases that were in the early 1990s. They involved two online services that I'll just say, when I tell my students about, they give me blank looks, like, what are you talking about? Those are CompuServe and Prodigy. So they were the early national dial-up online services. They had bulletin boards, chat rooms, other functions. Initially, they were fairly closed off. They had different content policies. And they both did have policies for user content, but CompuServe was much more free and open, while Prodigy wanted to distinguish itself and have be more family friendly. So Prodigy had more moderators, they removed more users, they had detailed policies, and what they said is, you know, we want kids to be able to do homework, research on Prodigy. So they had different business models, but they were hosting a lot of third-party content. So not surprisingly, they both eventually get sued for third-party content. For the first case involves CompuServe. There was a newsletter on a forum that a contractor managed. CompuServe gets sued, and the district court judge in the Southern District of New York dismisses the or grants summary judgment for CompuServe, under basically saying CompuServe is the electronic equivalent of a bookstore, and CompuServe exercises no more editorial control than a bookstore. So under that standard, CompuServe would only face liability if it knew or had reason to know of the defamatory content, and there was no evidence of that, so we'll grant summary judgment. Pretty straightforward. There were a lot of interesting cases dating back to the 50s involving bookstores along those lines. A few years later, this is where we get some colorful history. You have Stratton Oakmont and their president, Danny Porish. If that sounds familiar, that is the person who Jonah Hill's character in The Wolf of Wall Street is based on. He is accused of fraudulent activities in a Prodigy financial chat room, and or bulletin board. So he and Stratton Oakmont sue Prodigy for $200 million. And Prodigy, and this is in a state court in on Long Island, I'll say the judge had some issues. He had been censured a few years earlier for making inappropriate comments to litigants. He also made it fairly clear he wanted to make a statement about the internet. And he did. He made a statement that got quite a bit of media coverage for a state court opinion on the internet, where he said Prodigy does not get the same standard of liability that CompuServe received because of its additional editorial control, as he viewed it. He said, you know, because Prodigy holds itself out to moderate content, Prodigy should face the same liability as the people who posted the comments. And the case kind of fizzled out because Prodigy agreed to apologize, but it got a lot of attention because, and it got attention from some members of Congress because what they saw was this perverse incentive that if you did not moderate very much, you actually could reduce your liability. And this was in 1995, and this was as Congress was overhauling telecom laws for the first time in 60 years. And at the time, the concern about the internet as it was being deployed into libraries and classrooms was that children would be able to access pornography. There were Time and Newsweek had these really scary cover stories about children being exposed to pornography. So there was a, as the telecom laws were being overhauled in the Senate, there was a bill called the Communications Decency Act, which imposed certain types of liability for the transmission of types of indecent content. And there were was a wide spectrum of legislators from Pat Leahy to Newt Gingrich, who's speaker at the time, who said, you know, we really think this is unconstitutional. In the House, so that was in the Senate, they get it onto their bill. In the House, you have Chris Cox, a Republican, and Ron Wyden, a Democrat, who proposed the Internet Freedom and Family Empowerment Act. And this is what essentially Section 230 would become, but there are some important differences, especially compare. I'm glad that this PowerPoint is up because I'll just talk through them briefly. But what they basically were saying is we want to empower users and the platforms to protect, the debate was mainly about children, to protect children, to make their own decisions. The market is a better determinant, and we don't want to expose companies to liability for their decisions to moderate content. So they propose this Internet Freedom and Family Empowerment Act that gets overwhelmingly attached to the House version of the Telecom Act. There were some differences, though. One of the differences is all of those, and well, one thing is C1 was 25 words, which would have made a worse book title, so I'm glad that it's 26 words. The C1 and C2 were all one paragraph. There were a few other wording differences. And The liability protections got very little, actually no media coverage that I was able to find. What did get coverage was a provision that was deleted in conference committee. It was passed in the House but deleted in conference, that said the FCC cannot regulate internet content. And that was whenever anyone mentioned the Cox-Wyden bill, they said, oh, this is the bill that says the government can't regulate the internet. Now, I interviewed pretty much everyone who was in, I could find, who was still alive and was involved in the bill passage, and the idea was basically that conflicted a bit with the Senate's version, because as a compromise, both the Cox-Wyden bill and the Senate CDA got placed in the final Telecom Act, which is why it's known as Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. There also, interestingly, in subsection E, there is now a line that was not in the original 230 that says that Section 230 preempts any inconsistent state law, state liability under state laws. So that's also important. So it kind of shifted in conference committee to be a bit more of liability protection. But again, I mean, the media coverage, most of the media coverage was about things that I personally find to be a little boring, which was about things like local telephone rates and long distance. No one was saying, hey, this is going to provide this huge liability protection for companies, because we were talking about AOL and Prodigy at the time, so there really wasn't much analysis, and it really wouldn't be clear how broad that liability protection would be until you started having courts interpret Section 230, but they both pass, and then the day that they're signed into law on February 8th, 1996, civil liberties groups challenge the Senate's version, and the Supreme Court ultimately strikes that down. So what's remaining of what's in the Telecom Act as the CDA is Section 230. And the important thing to note, and much of my book focuses on C1, because I focus primarily on the litigation, is what does it mean to say that you shall not treat an interactive computer service as the publisher or speaker of third-party content? One interpretation that you could have, and some people have recently made it, but it was made at the beginning, was all that means is that there's distributor liability for all interactive computer services, which means there's liability if they know or have reason to know. And I think both of those terms are very much up for debate as to what those actually mean. But that's one reading. Or, and this is the reading that Judge Wilkinson would take the next year and it would become widely adopted, is that distributor liability is a subset of this publisher or speaker liability. And that is what the courts ultimately adopted. Now, I know I'm running, I want to stay on time, and I know Professor Volokh is going to talk more about the interplay of C1 or C2, so I perhaps will stop there and let you talk about how the interpretation has worked.
Thank you very much, and thank you. It's an excellent presentation, but also an excellent segue, because C1 and C2 are closely related. A lot of the debates are these days about one or the other, but it does help to step back and think about both. And here's one way of thinking about it. Before the internet, let's look at a newspaper or a magazine. Newspapers traditionally in recent decades, relatively objective. Magazines often quite ideological. If you look at liability, newspapers and magazines are potentially liable for material that they publish, including both by their own employees, but also by third parties, columnists, authors of letters to the editor. Magazines, for example, often have lots of things from all sorts of people. So if you think about it in C1 model, they are publishers, they're treated as publishers, they're subject to liability, subject, of course, to broad First Amendment protections against libel law under cases like Sullivan and the like, but potentially subject to liability. At the same time, without question, they have very broad power, almost unlimited power, to restrict availability of material, to just refuse to publish something. There's a famous precedent, Miami Herald v. Tornello, says that a state can't order a newspaper to publish, say, replies to criticisms of office holders. Indeed, if you think about it, a magazine that didn't restrict availability to material, or a newspaper, would be useless. I mean, imagine a newspaper that said, we have a content-neutral policy. We will publish every letter to the editor and article submitted to us. Who would want to read such a thing, right? So both functionally and constitutionally, newspapers and magazines have broad potential liability, but also broad, basically unlimited rights to choose what to include and what to exclude. Let's take one step over, a bookstore or a library or a newsstand. Those are called, under libel law generally speaking, distributors. A bookstore is only liable under what today might be called a notice and takedown model, because a bookstore is not expected to read every book that's on the shelves. A newsstand is not expected to read every publication that it distributes. So a bookstore has immunity unless somebody tells it, look, this book libels me and gives enough evidence that the bookstore is now on notice that it's potentially or likely libelous. So the bookstore has some liability, qualified, limited as a distributor, and at the same time, there's no case law that I know of on this, but I think it's pretty broadly expected that bookstores also have the right to decide what to include and what not to include. That's why you have Christian bookstores, feminist bookstores, free market bookstores, whatever you want. And that too is, by the way, quite valuable. Many people, when they go to one of those specialist bookstores, trust or rely on the bookstore for its judgment about what to exclude as much as what to include. All right. And there's a third category, which doesn't have a formal libel law label, but was known to the courts. One might call it a conduit or a platform. Classic example, a phone company. There was a case from the 1970s in New York where basically somebody had an answering machine message back when there were such things, which was allegedly libelous. And the libeled party sued the phone company saying, hey, they refused to cut off the service. And the New York court said, well, they have complete liability. They have total immunity. They have like what today would be called C1 immunity. But at the same time, note that phone companies are prohibited from just blocking people whose speech they dislike. I mean, imagine that they learned that the KKK is using a phone line for its recruiting, or Antifa, or the communists, or whatever else. And not by listening in on the conversation, just because there are leaflets being handed out saying, call this number to hear our message. The phone company, nobody says, well, doesn't the phone company have an obligation to make sure its property is not misused for these nefarious purposes? No, they don't even have the right to do that. They're a common carrier. Another example is UPS or FedEx. They're not going to be liable for things they deliver, in part precisely because they have no right to control what they deliver based on content, because they're common carriers. So here's the interesting thing. For the historical reasons that Jeff mentions, Section 230 deliberately, there's no question that was a deliberate choice on Congress's part, provides online platforms with, under one, the libel law protection offered to platforms, but under two, the editorial discretion offered to newspapers or to bookstores. It's a hybrid model, which in a sense gives them the best of both worlds. I'm saying that purely descriptively. It may be perfectly legitimate. Sometimes we do give various entities the best of both worlds. But just important, if you want to position it somewhere, this immunity in C1 is not unheard of under the law. That was the traditional model for phone companies. The immunity, and some other, I can give you some other examples, the immunity under C2 is not unheard of. In fact, that is the First Amendment protected model for newspapers, magazines, probably bookstores. It's just the combination that was novel. So that leaves a couple of questions that I think we have time for. One is, when you've got C2, the immunity that's offered, how broad is the immunity? And there basically have been two readings, including both among courts and commentators. One is, it says, look, or otherwise objectionable. Let's say a platform decides it wants to remove certain material because it believes it's racist, or believes it's pro-terrorist, or believes it's unpatriotic, or just believes that it's against the business's own business interests. Is it objectionable to it? Well, yes, they're objecting, so therefore they're entitled to do this. The other option is to follow the canon which I will pronounce, although I don't think there is a fixed pronunciation, Eusdem Generis, spelled Justum Generis, maybe. That's probably other people pronounce it that way. And it literally means, I've confirmed this on Google Translate and other sources, the same kind. And the premise there is, when you see obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, excessively violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable, it doesn't mean objectionable in any way, because then why list those particular ways? It means objectionable in the same kind of way. And in fact, there are lots of cases, those of you who handle cases involving statutory construction often find this. Like, you could talk about this, that, or other, I think there was one example, or other entities engaged in commerce. Is it engaged in commerce under the Commerce Clause, which is basically any commercial transaction? No, in light of the things that preceded, it looks like it's engaged in commerce in the sense of transportation of goods and services. So one question, of course, with the same kind is, what is that kind of thing? So you might say, well, it's all sexually themed, obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy. But what about violent and harassing? That may not be sexual at all. So it turns out, Adam Candiub from Michigan State and I just recently published an article where we say, look, there's actually one thing that unites all of those, which these, all of those adjectives, all of them are traditionally recognized bases for regulating telecommunications. We know, for example, that lascivious, indecent material can be regulated on radio and television. That's the seven dirty words case. We know that harassing phone calls can be regulated. At the time, Congress believed that violent speech on television could be regulated. There was certainly talk about that, Congress and FCC. And what's more, if you look at the Communications Decency Act, in which Section 230 was passed, which is itself part of the Telecommunications Act, basically you look through the headings for the sections, you see those terms appearing. And I think one of them may be violent, does not appear in the headings, but it appears in the body. Every single one of those terms appears in either the heading, mostly, or in the body of some other provision in the CDA. So we think that the best way of understanding C2A is by saying essentially that it gives a federally protected right to social media platforms to basically exclude material that is like that. Not for ideological reasons, even ones that we can sort of understand why they'd want to engage in, but basically because it's perceived as sexually themed or excessively violent or harassing in the sense that a telephone call that's addressed to a person who doesn't want it can be covered. So we don't think that otherwise objectionable is all-encompassing. And at least certainly some lower court decisions have taken our view, as well as the opposite. So this is actually a live debate. So let me just close by flagging a few things. I know we're about Section 230, but can't just talk about Section 230. So one thing, of course, is C1 been tremendously important. Why? Because it preempts laws that actually exist, libel law, at least as applied to the platforms. Invasion of privacy law, negligence law, all of these laws. Section C2 preempts laws that mostly do not exist. Because even in the absence of C2, imagine I sue Twitter for taking down my Twitter feed, and they say, well, what's the basis? Oh, First Amendment. Well, we're not a state actor, right? So there's no cause of action under the First Amendment. Well, what about prohibition on political discrimination? There are no prohibitions on political discrimination under most state laws. You could gin up some theories. So for example, California law has been interpreted as banning political affiliation discrimination in places of public accommodation. So maybe in the absence of C2, you could have, or even with a narrow reading of C2, you could have that law apply. Maybe, but that's kind of a stretch. So C2 is only becoming super important now because states for the first time are really passing statutes, like in Texas, like in Florida, that try to restrict that. So one question that arises, even setting aside the scope of C2, is there a state cause of action? Second question that arises is that state cause of action constitutional under the First Amendment? Remember, publishers, newspapers, have a constitutional right to exclude whatever they please. Bookstores probably do too. Do platforms as well? I wrote an 86-page article saying, maybe. And I think that actually certain kinds of these Texas and Florida-like laws are constitutional, but at least the Florida law that I looked at is not, for a variety of reasons, one of which not only does it ban platforms from excluding materials, it bans platforms from essentially flagging material, as they say, as what they say is incorrect, and that's their own speech. That's protected by the First Amendment. So I don't think there's a right to be free from being compelled to host material on your site, generally speaking. But there certainly is there are other First Amendment rights that are in play. One last thing we have to ask is, what about the Dormant Commerce Clause? The internet is an interstate medium. It's an international medium. Imagine the state of South Dakota says, well, you have to block certain material, and North Dakota says you can't block certain material. Could be tough. So one question is whether this is just a federal question, even setting aside Section 230, because of the problems with state laws applying it. This having been said, libel law is state law, invasion of privacy law is state law. Even with 230C1, there's still causes of action against speakers, against the original posters. So those are all state law causes of action for interstate communications, and they're generally allowed. So it's an interesting question. Jack Goldsmith and I are co-writing an article on the subject as to what extent the Dormant Commerce Clause comes into play. But those are the kind of issues that arise with 230C2 and this whole question of material being blocked.
Thank you, Professor Volokh. And Jonathan Mitchell would remind you that the Dormant Commerce Clause is not actually in the text of the Constitution. So, Ms. Tumarillo, can I ask you to now comment on Section 230 in practice?
Yes, absolutely. And thank you so much for having me. As the judge mentioned, I'm the executive director of Engine. It's a nonprofit based in DC that works with thousands of startups across the country. And I think their voice is particularly important here because so many conversations about Section 230 are cast in this bigger net of big tech frustrations and problems. And I understand that. I too am a user of big tech services, and I get the frustrations. But Section 230 is a lot bigger and more important than kind of grudges against one company or another. In fact, you know, I would argue, and lots of smart people do, that Facebook and Google don't really need Section 230 anymore. It's the startups we work with that need Section 230. And it's not just social media companies, right? It's comments on news articles. It's customer reviews. It's photo hosting and sharing. We work with a startup that all they do is host photos to help train computer vision models. And those photos are user-generated content. The company doesn't make it themselves. And they're all protected by 230. If someone were to upload a photo that was illegal or defamatory or you name it, the company wouldn't get in trouble, the person who uploaded it would. So when we talk about 230, we tend to think about big social media companies, but it's much broader than that, and I think the conversation should really kind of reflect that diversity. So in thinking about Section 230, there are two really harsh realities that startups, but also big companies, face, and I think we need to grapple with those realities when we think about free speech online and expression online generally. The first is that speech is really, really messy. As much as I wish, and everyone probably wishes, we could write a law that says, keep all the good stuff up and take all the bad stuff down, we just can't. We can't really agree on what's good and what's bad. Engine does events with congressional staff and startups often where we'll pose these hypotheticals to the audience. We'll say, okay, here is a hypothetical piece of content. Here's the relevant terms of service and the relevant stated principles of the company. Do you think the content violates the principles and the terms of service? Should it be left up or should it be taken down? And without fail, we never get a consensus. The rooms full of Hill staff can't agree. The rooms full of startups can't agree. I bet if I did the poll right here, you guys couldn't agree. So it's not as straightforward as good versus bad. And in fact, you know, it's incredibly difficult to write those policies to begin with. And as much as the companies, you know, I'm sure make mistakes. I know they make mistakes. I know it's very frustrating to be on the receiving end of those mistakes. The fact of the matter is speech is really hard to regulate around, including in the private sector. I think, you know, if we tried to get this whole room to write a terms of service about what should be left up and what should be taken down, heck, if we tried to get this panel to write a terms of service, I'm not sure we could come to a consensus. And even if we could come to a consensus, right, speech and culture and context, they change so quickly. Something that's totally okay today, that we could all agree is totally okay today, by next week, because of news or slang words changing, or heck, the different use of emojis, could be totally not okay next week. And so even if we can agree, which again, we can't, but if we could agree, it's not lasting. It would have to be rewritten constantly. So that's the first reality. The second reality is even if you could get consensus, speech is impossible to find and remove in real time, especially at scale. Jeff's book talks about this. In 2018, there were 6,000 tweets per second. There were 60,000 Instagram posts per minute, and there were 3 million Facebook posts per minute. And yes, those are the big companies, so that's a lot of content. But even small startups fastly, their users fastly outpace what they can moderate by hand. So it's impossible to enforce terms of service and kind of speech principles in real time as you grow. The big tech companies, they got a lot of money. They can build fancy algorithms to try to find stuff as it's uploaded, and there are some cases where they do that and it works pretty well around like terrorist content. And they can hire tens of thousands of content moderators. Mark Zuckerberg has said in front of Congress that they have tens of thousands of content moderators. I mean, the average startup has like maybe 10 people. So tens of thousands of content moderators are very far out of reach. Both of those things, the technology, the automated filtering, the algorithms, and the human moderators are incredibly expensive. That should be obvious. One of the best examples is YouTube has spent at least $100 million on Content ID, which is their copyright detection tool. When you upload something to YouTube, it passes through this filter and it makes sure that licensed music isn't played in the video. They've spent $100 million just in cash, and they've also spent, obviously, many man hours of time building the tool, maintaining the tool, fixing the tool. And even that doesn't work that well. There are a bunch of really high-profile cases of Content ID going way off the rails and failing to recognize things like fair use or misidentifying cover songs as being the original. And so Content ID, which is kind of the best example we have of what big tech can do if it puts all its money behind something, doesn't work that well, and it's still kind of the gold standard as far as the industry goes because it is so hard to do this. So, really hard to regulate speech generally, including within a private company. Even if you can agree on what's good and what's bad, it's almost impossible to find it in real time as you scale. Thankfully, we have Section 230. I think without Section 230, we would kind of be trying to fit those two really messy realities in that they're square pegs in the round hole of legal certainty that companies and their investors need. So Section 230, as we've all discussed, kind of says, don't worry, you're not going to be held liable if you're not going to be held liable if something bad gets uploaded, and you're not going to be held liable if something bad gets uploaded, even if you're trying to find that something bad before it can be shared. Without Section 230, it's really hard to imagine any new startups would enter this space and say, yeah, let me host user-generated content. I want to host those photos. I want to host those customer reviews. I want to host those comments. I want to be that Reddit subthread. Because you could be sued out of existence with one lawsuit from one disgruntled user. We've done some research, and even with Section 230 in place, it can cost tens of thousands of dollars to get a case dismissed at the 12B6 stage. So that's under current law, a company is doing all the right stuff, and somebody says something that somebody else says is defamatory, and they go to sue them in court. A startup needs to front between $15,000 and $80,000 to get that case thrown out, again, with Section 230 in place. Without Section 230, you're talking about a much longer litigation process that could go into the hundreds of thousands of dollars. The average seed stage startup, so that's a startup that is successful enough to start attracting outside investment. So not the like two guys in a garage, not the two guys in a dorm room. This is a company that has a product and is going to investors and is saying, this is something real, please give me money. The average seed stage startup has about $55,000 a month to spend. And that's maybe sounds like a decent amount of money, but that's on staff, that's on R&D, that's on space, it's on equipment, it's on marketing. That 55K goes real fast. Currently, one lawsuit over a piece of user-generated content can wipe out a month of runway for a startup. Without 230, I mean, you could wipe out a whole year or a whole funding round easily with one case. So Congress had the wherewithal to put this into law early on, and that's why we have the internet of user-generated content that we have today. And again, I would stress that's not just social media. That's much bigger than social media. And 230 also encourages and protects platforms who want to differentiate, right? What makes sense and what is reasonable on one platform is not going to be the same on a different platform. The best example is there is a subreddit called Cats on Their Hind Legs, or Cats Standing on Their Hind Legs. And it is literally just pictures of cats standing on their hind legs. And, you know, the joke is, like, you could really want to see a dog standing on its hind legs or a lemur standing on its hind legs. That is not allowed on that subreddit. It is just cats on its hind legs. I encourage everyone to look at it. It is, cats are funny. So 230, right, not just protects the platforms that want to host speech and want to create environments for speech. It also enables them to create specific environments. And there are a lot of other kind of legal foundations that enable that, but 230 is the procedural shortcut that makes sure that they can create the product and service they want without being sued out of existence early on. And then that's also super important from the investor side, because an investor is not going to invest $1 million in some company if they think that, one, the company is one day going to basically become, you know, obligated to host everything, right? That differentiation is usually a market advantage, and if you can't differentiate, then the whole internet becomes like the magazines that have to print everything, and that's not super useful and something that people would want to spend time and money on. But also, an investor's not going to want to invest a bunch of money if it's going to go right to plaintiff's attorneys on the first go because they're being sued for something that they didn't actually do. So that's why 230 is super important to startups. And kind of taking a step back, I think it's really important to make sure we're not missing the forest for the trees here. 30 years ago, if you wanted to build an audience, you were limited by the number of people who could fit around your dining table, your ability to get a TV show, your ability to get a letter to the editor to publish, your ability to get a radio show, your ability to get a magazine column or a book deal, right? And then the internet came along, and now anybody can build an audience and reach, you know, tens, hundreds, thousands of people relatively easily compared to before the internet. And yes, there are still gatekeepers, but I would argue there are many more gatekeepers than there were 30 years ago. We're not just relying on Condé Nast and the New York Times. And more importantly, anybody can become a gatekeeper. Anybody with a good idea and a connection to the internet can launch the next social media platform or the next photo sharing platform or the next, you name it, customer review platform. And the ability of kind of our startup ecosystem to innovate so quickly and to be able to launch these products and services that get into the hands of consumers and allow people to build audiences is a direct result of our intermediary liability framework, including Section 230.
Thank you, Ms. Tumorello. So, Mr. Barnes, we will turn it to you to talk about what states and courts are doing.
Thanks very much, Judge Starr. So let me premise my remarks with a disclaimer similar to Jeff's, which is that although I represent the state of Florida and its defense of the law that Eugene wrongly called unconstitutional a moment ago, what I'm going to say here is not on behalf of Florida, but just myself. And let me focus for a moment on the case law as it relates to the relationship between sections C1 and C2, and in particular, an interesting issue or an important issue in this field is the question of what exactly does it mean for an internet or an interactive computer service to be treated as a publisher or speaker. And if you just read that phrase, treated as the publisher or speaker in isolation, without thinking about C2 at all, you might interpret it in either of two ways. One is to say, well, a publisher traditionally, it decides what material to run and what material not to run. And so anytime you're in that space of deciding whether to allow material on your platform or not, you're covered by C1. The problem with that reading of the statute is that it doesn't really leave any work for subsection C2 to actually do. And if you read the two provisions together, I would submit that I think the much better reading of the statutory text is that really C1 is focused on the traditional situation where you have someone suing an internet company for defamation for leaving up content that somebody else finds objectionable, versus C2, which speaks to situations where you're talking about a platform's decision to remove content. And if you don't adopt that distinction under C1 and C2, you come very close, if not all the way, to basically concluding that C2 is a nullity in the statute. There's just no work left for C2 to do. And one of the things that I think is very interesting about the moment we're in right now with respect to Section 230 is Eugene has written these very interesting things about the meaning of C2, but if you take the broader reading of C1, and this is the reading that is most prevalent in the courts today, if you take the broader reading of C1, the whole debate about the meaning of C2 is basically irrelevant, because you know whether the platform acts in good faith or not, whatever it means for content to be otherwise objectionable, none of it really matters, because platforms, by and large, can just invoke C1 and avoid all liability. Another point that I think is important to recognize in terms of the way the case law in this area has developed is, again, as Eugene referenced, there isn't an obvious sort of common law cause of action that people can bring when they're disgruntled about having their content removed from a platform. Whereas in contrast, defamation, breach of contract, there are various causes of action that come to mind more easily when we're talking about a platform leaving content up that's defamatory or otherwise legally problematic or illegal. And as a result, over the last 25 years of the existence of this statute, virtually all of the cases, and with maybe one exception, every case that I'm aware of that's gotten up to the Federal Court of Appeals has concerned leaving content up as opposed to potential liability for taking it down. And the result of that is that when courts have spoken to the issue of when is a platform potentially immunized from liability for removing content, it's almost invariably been in dicta. And in the handful of cases that we've had where someone has actually brought a claim of one sort or another before the Florida and Texas laws came around, someone has actually brought a claim against a platform for removing content, it's been typically in a context where you had a bit of a David and Goliath situation in court, where you had maybe a fairly unsophisticated plaintiff who might have been represented pro se, or not well resourced, going up against some giant internet platform. And unsurprisingly, in that context, the handful of judicial opinions that we've gotten out of that haven't really grappled with this issue. And it's really been in the last year or so, is my sense, that commentators and courts have sort of woken up to, well, wait a minute, does this phrase treated as the publisher or speaker, is it properly understood as broad enough to reach situations where a platform is removing content as opposed to leaving it up? And so the funny place where we find the law today is basically there's a lot of dicta out there in cases where this issue wasn't really properly presented, but also I think a recognition among commentators that that dicta is very difficult, I would submit, to reconcile with the overall statutory text, given that you're not left with much in C2 if you read C1 for in the very broad way that the social media platforms lawyers want to. This issue is going to be a very actively litigated issue in the near future, and it's partly because the state of Florida has enacted a law that it's got a number of provisions, and Eugene made reference to one of them. I'll focus on a different one, actually, which is a provision that basically says that social media platforms are required to publish in advance their rules for deciding what material to take down, and then they're required under the Florida law to apply those rules in a consistent manner. Now, they're allowed, actually, to have viewpoint discriminatory rules. They just have to announce them in advance and disclose them to the public. Our view, the Florida's position in the litigation is that to the extent that Section 230 speaks to a law of that sort at all, it's Section C2 as opposed to C1. That's interestingly, the district court, a group of internet trade associations sued the state of Florida, sought a preliminary injunction. The district court issued a preliminary injunction against the law, mostly on First Amendment grounds, but it did, the provision I mentioned, it did enjoin the law as well as preempted under Section 230. But interestingly, it invokes Section C2 as opposed to C1. And without, really addressing the threshold C1 issue, which I think bespeaks, at least to some extent, or reflects the kind of growing recognition that C1 has, traditionally been read too broadly. We just recently filed our opening brief in an interlocutory appeal in that case where we're challenging the district court's reading of Section 230. One thing to note on C2, our case is a is a pre-enforcement challenge, facial challenge, and obviously with a preemption facial challenge, you've got to show that there's no application of the law that would be consistent with the federal statute. And the district court didn't really grapple in our case with the issue of the good faith provision of subsection C2. It said, well, you know, it's sometimes platforms pull content down in good faith, and so this Florida statute's preempted. But you know, the other side of it is platforms don't always act in good faith, and to the extent that they don't, you know, we think it's reasonably clear that Section 230 doesn't preempt the law. But the thing that is interesting about it is that the district court didn't embrace that broader reading of C1 that we see in a lot of dicta and from other district courts. So maybe I'll stop there with recognition of the limited time we've got, but obviously a lot of important issues with respect to the meaning of what Section 230 means. And I guess the one final thought is, for a law that's as important as this one is and that has as much of a presence in the political consciousness as this one does, it's surprising how thin the case law is and underdeveloped the law is with respect to this issue of taking down content as opposed to potential liability for leaving it up.
Thank you. I appreciate the opening remarks from our panelists. So I'll ask a question in the meantime while the audience gathers together whatever questions they want to ask. You can go ahead and approach the mics if you want to. And we'll try to wrap the session up around 12:35. So question I want to pose to y'all is, there are a number of members of Congress who are talking about problems with Section 230, but it takes 60 senators to agree and result in a legislative change. Do you think they will, or do you think the progress in this area is left to court interpretations and state actions? Any thoughts on what Congress might or might not do from our panel?
I guess I'll just say I meet with members and their staffers all the time across the aisle. And I often feel like I'm having two entirely different conversations, which maybe is normal. I fortunately am not a political scientist, thankfully, because I mean, half the conversations are very much, there's too much harmful content on the internet. We need to change Section 230, and even if this is constitutionally protected, we need to change Section 230 to figure out a way to get it down. And then the other concerns are, we think the platforms are discriminating against certain people based on their viewpoints unfairly, and this is having huge impacts on society, and we have to figure out how to change Section 230 to address that. And then we drill a little deeper and we say, well, how do we do that? And there are some interesting proposals on both sides. My challenge, and I've really struggled with this, is how do you reconcile those two? And you'd mentioned some transparency requirements. And I think that might be one of the common threads that I see from both sides this is the fault of a few of the very large tech companies that operated for years. I my other area of research is cybersecurity, and it was often easier to get information from the NSA than it was from some of these big tech companies about how they handle user content. And I think that's a frustration that both sides share, but when it comes to actually using 230 as a lever on moderation, I think even if there was a constitutional and effective way of doing it, I don't see the 60 votes. I think it would be very challenging.
Professor Volong?
Well, so let's go back to 2010. Now, what was in the news? Not 230, it was Citizens United, right? 5-4 decision. Comfortable saying that much of the media was on the side of the four dissenters, who, by the way, had a very plausible argument and had to do with corporate and union speech about candidates and spending on such speech, but of course an organization can't speak without spending. And the dissenters, headed by Justice Stevens, said, look, here these entities are using their economic power and trying to leverage it into political power. And that could drown out the voices, could undermine the speech of real human beings. Because corporations just get to speak, get to buy ads about candidates. Now, I think the majority got it right on balance there, that corporations and unions ought to be allowed to to spend their money on expressing their own speech. But here you've got corporations, some of the biggest corporations in the world, certainly in the country, leveraging their economic power to get political power, not just by expressing themselves, which I totally agree they have the right to do with things like fact checks and such, but by actually blocking speech, to be sure only on their own platforms, but on tremendously important platforms. That, it seems to me, is a very serious concern. Now, to be sure, I'm a big believer in private property rights, and lots of people in Congress are also big believers in private property rights. And on balance, I think, if in doubt, and I remain myself in doubt at this point, I'm not sure what the right answer is, but when in doubt, err on the side of allowing private entities to control their property as they like. But at some point, we might say that just like we're uncomfortable with telephone companies making these decisions about, especially in closely contested elections and political disputes, where even a bit of a thumb on the scales may make a big difference, we might feel uncomfortable with telephone companies doing that. We maybe feel uncomfortable with Google, let's say Google in the YouTube capacity and Facebook and Twitter doing that. Now, you asked the political question. I don't know where there are going to be 60 votes, but you know, so much has surprised me about American politics over the last 5-10 years. I've totally given up my any confidence I didn't have much to begin with in my ability to predict American politics. But I do think that the thing that's driving some of this is the sense that, you know, Facebook and Twitter are not like the cat subreddit, in part because they are tremendously, and they acknowledge themselves to be tremendously important kind of infrastructure for American political debate, and I'd say the same in other countries as well, and that it seems to me to make sense that both people on the left and on the right would have considerable misgivings about having use this power again, not just to speak, which many people have enough misgivings about corporations speaking, but actually to block speech by important players in political debates. So that's why I think there's some room here for action at the federal level, political room, but again, very hard to tell with any degree of confidence.
If I could add to what Jeff said about transparency, I think there's also a lot of agreement, even across the aisle, on an appeals process that feels very it's intuitive, we understand it, someone says you can't do something, you want to at least hear why and make sure that that thought was all the way thought through. I have practical concerns as someone who talks to companies that would have to implement this stuff, but I do think transparency and appeals are like the two areas of overlap. I feel like Jeff is maybe generously describing it as two different kinds of conversations. I feel like maybe it's like 10 different kinds of conversations. And certainly the should companies be able to suppress speech is a big one. I do think it is predominantly on one side of the aisle, and there is not a ton of interest on the other side of engaging with that. But there are kind of like niche facets to the online content conversation. So around like consumer protection, I think that's something that there is bipartisan interest in. If you like mention child safety, everyone's ears perk up. So I think there are little like snippets of the 230 conversation that are picking up steam, but I'm not sure that Congress would be satisfied with the one bite at the apple they might get on doing something so narrow. So I think there's a lot of things could happen. I don't think anything is destined to happen at this point.
Understood. Do you want to chime in?
Yeah, I don't have any particular insights into the politics of this, but my only thought is we need to know what the statute we've got means before we yes. go amending it, and I don't think we really know what it means yet.
Understood. Okay, so anyone can ask a question. You just need a name tag, Mr. Shaw, if you're here. Your name tag's still here. So any questions? Mr. Mile.
Hi there. Connor Mile, former...
Right?
Oh.
Please proceed.
Hi there. I'm your former law clerk, Judge Starr,
yes,
Connor Miles.
Good to see you again. Former as of yesterday at 5 o'clock, right?
That is correct. I think many people don't engage with 230's actual text when they talk about it, so thank you all on the panel for doing that today. I want to focus on C2A briefly. Many call it a blanket immunity, but Professor Volokh, you mentioned one hole in the blanket with otherwise objectionable and eustem generis. But what about the good faith requirement? Mr. Barnes, you mentioned it. Do any of you think this opens websites to suits by private persons that they censor, alleging that that they didn't do so in good faith?
You know, I tried to figure out what good faith means here. I've never particularly liked the phrase because it's so unclear what it means. But it's there, so we definitely need to interpret it. If you look at the typical situation where good faith is used as a term either in a statute or in a common law rule, it tends to have to do with honesty. So some people say, well, it can't be in good faith to block things based on viewpoint. Sure it can. I can in good faith believe that some viewpoint is a bad viewpoint. There's no bad faith about that. All of us in good faith believe that some viewpoints are bad viewpoints, right? One example that I think that some people have suggested, which I think is probably right, is imagine somebody says, well, I think this is objectionable, but really what I don't like about it is this comes from a competitor of mine, and I want to squash that competitor. So that's an example. I mean, if you really read objectionable super broadly, then that you might say, well, it is objectionable. It's objectionable for me to help have my property be used to help my competitors. But if you read, if you read objectionable more narrowly, whether under the eustem generis interpretation or some other version, then you might say that there's got to be that good faith requires that you really sincerely believe that this is one or the other. And here's how it might play out, and then I'll close. Imagine that we do say it's got to be kind of something that fits within that or similar category. But remember, it says considers to be. So let's say somebody says, I think that depictions of certain, let's say not pornography, but certain kinds of semi-nudity are filthy. And other people say, or lascivious, other people say, no, not at all. They're lovely and wonderful and artistic. It seems to me that A says, the question is whether I consider, if I'm running the site, it to be filthy. And if I do, then I'm okay. But I've got to consider it in good faith, which means if I say I think it's filthy, what's filthy about it? There's no nudity, there's no nothing, but it expresses some political viewpoint. But I'm saying it's filthy. That might suggest that I'm lying, that I'm not really being honest. So I think good faith only makes sense if we read those terms as not all-encompassing. And then if we see that there's a lot of discretion given to the provider in that the question is whether they consider it to be one of those, but B, the discretion is limited, they've got to have a good faith belief. It doesn't have to be a belief that the court agrees with, but it has to be at least something that the fact finder concludes, yes, they really were thinking, however prudish they may be, that this was filthy, let's say, and weren't just using it as an excuse for something that clearly isn't covered. That's my sense.
Anyone else want to chime in on good faith?
Yeah, I would just agree. I mean, there's very little case law that has interpreted that, and for C2 in general. I would just also add, and this is just a bit of a side note, we do also have to look at C2B as well. That has been important in some malware and other cybersecurity related cases as well, addressing the in terms of the ability to provide that, and there have been some issues about anti-competitive, can it be done anti-competitive as opposed to being in good faith? So, I think that the considers to be is a really important provision, but I think Eric Goldman did an article a few years ago where he exhaustively looked at good faith, and there were maybe like three or four cases altogether that substantively interpreted it.
So just two quick thoughts on this related to the limits of the scope of C2. One is, in addition to the good faith requirement, there's also this phrase held liable that you see there, and there's at least one court that has suggested, I think it's an Eastern District of Virginia opinion, that to be held liable, that only references liability for damages as opposed to injunctive relief. So there's a live issue there. And then another way potentially of getting around C2 preemption is there's this phrase, restrict access to or availability of material. And the Florida law, as I mentioned, it's completely neutral as to the ability of a platform to have viewpoint discriminatory rules for content moderation. It just requires them to announce them in advance and apply them consistently. And you might question whether a law of that sort limits the ability of a platform to actually restrict access to or the availability of material, as opposed to just imposing some procedural requirements a platform has to go through when it wants to restrict access or availability of material. So those are two other ways of potentially getting around C2.
If I can just quickly flag one concern I have here. As I was mentioning to Kate, I've discovered the lawyer's true superpower, and that's the power to turn every question into a question about procedure. And procedural proposals sound appealing in part because they seem less limiting than substantive restrictions. But the problem is if you require rules to be announced and then enforced even-handedly, the problem is then there's going to be a lot of litigation about what is and was not even-handed, which may be proved quite difficult. Let me give you an illustration near and dear to my heart. I grade exams, and I'm supposed to grade exams fairly. And I actually have my own rubric to try to guide it, saying, you know, this many points for this, this many points for that. But imagine the school said, you know, we're not going to restrict your grading of the exams at all. We're just going to require you to announce what you're giving points for, and then we can allow people to challenge your grading because it's unfair compared to some other exam, which presumably they'd get discovery of. And they're going to say, well, exam number 3744 said the following in this way, and 3792 said the following in that way. And you gave 3 points to this and only 1 point to this. You know, that would be a very serious barrier to my ability to actually grade things in a good faith way. It would also be a serious barrier to my ability to grade things in a bad faith way. Maybe it's a good restriction, but it's a very substantial restriction that could lead to a tremendous amount of litigation and a tremendous chilling effect. Like if that were the rule, I would probably shift a lot to multiple choice exams because those are the only ones that really would be defensible against that sort of thing. So just requirements of kind of an appeals process, so long as you can challenge the substantive outcome of the appeal, rather than just say, well, we're giving you an appeal. Okay, fine, you gave an appeal, that's it. So requirements of an appeals process and requirements of setting forth the rules, I think, end up being highly constraining in a way very similar to, and maybe in some ways greater than, substantive restrictions.
Well, thank you to our panel. I'll turn it back over to Barry White to tell us what's next in store for the day, but thank you to our members of the panel for enlightening us.